welcome, friends, to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We're just one of many that are listed on the back internationally, and whatever meeting you go to, you will hear the same things, which is the we are promulgating the teachings, the ancient teachings of Theosophy. And this is the declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists that you will hear at every lodge. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification of practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among Theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond being its associates, between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among Theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as Theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true Theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Before we get started, can I ask the usher to bring up a voice of the silence, please? No, the Gita. So in order for this lodge to promulgate these ideas and to fulfill the goals of the philosophy, we meet 2 times a week. Thank you. On Sundays, as now, the doors open at 10:30. The meeting runs from 11 until 12. And then afterwards, the book table is open before and after all meetings. On Wednesdays, we are still in the Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. The meeting runs from 7:30 until 8:30, and the library on Wednesdays is open from 5:15 until 7:15. The library is a reference library, and we encourage people to come in to read the reference for the class that night and the part as well to read so we can all be prepared for the class. The lodge is financially sustained entirely by voluntary contributions, and the activities here depend on voluntary offerings in time and work. Everyone you see up on the platform, helping out in the library, at the book table, we're all volunteers, and we give freely of our time. And all are invited to participate. No obligation is imposed or implied. February, the Sunday umbrella topic is the facets of self-discipline. Today's topic is raising the self by the self. Next week will be the renunciation of self-interest. And we did want to make one point in regards to today's class. The Declaration actually talks about that work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. So we think that's a good way to at least get ourselves into the mood for today's class. How we will run today's class is that the first talk will be on when we talk about the self by the self, what is the self that we are actually talking about? And then the second talk will be a little more specific in discussing how do we raise the self by the self. So in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 6, on page 45, there's a short reading that we think is very apropos to today's class. And this is Krishna talking. He should raise the self by the self. Let him not suffer the self to be lowered. For self is the friend of self. And in like manner, self is its own enemy. Self is the friend of the man who is self-conquered. So self, like a foe, hath enmity to him who is not self-conquered. And it goes on talking about the one self opposing the other self. So it is a rather confusing idea when we talk about raising the self by the self. And when we look at the idea of what is self anyway, I mean, out in, you know, in the outer world, when people talk about the self, they're not talking about the self the same way Theosophy talks about the self. Somebody says, myself, myself is how people usually term, put the two together. So myself, what is myself? Isn't self mine to begin with? So there's this whole, even in regular terminology, the idea of what is self. When you think about myself, when we actually think of in our heads, in our minds, what does that mean? What is the feeling behind that, myself? Are we looking at a personality? Are we looking at what Theosophy looks at is the individuality? So when we think of the theosophical way of the term self, we need to look at the idea of man being sevenfold. The four lower characteristics that are we look at the passions and desires, we look at the idea of the body, we look at the idea of the energy that goes behind everything, and this is all temporary. This is all a temporary thing that dies with each life. But when we look at the higher triad, that the higher, that piece of us that continues from life to life, that of mind, buddhi, which is the storehouse of all knowledge, and atma, which is spirit, these are the three. This is the triad. This is the theosophical triad. And it is this triad that is involved with the idea of self. Yet, the philosophy also puts forth that once in manifestation in these bodies, everything is dual. So when we look at the idea of mind or manas, there is a higher and a lower aspect to mind. The lower aspect being pulled towards those passions and desires, the higher mind being pulled more that spiritual aspect of buddhi. So this is, when we look at the higher self and the lower self then, this is what we're looking at. We are looking at the higher self as being Atma, buddhi, and higher mind, and lower mind, and the passions as desires being the lower self. Yet the funny thing is that both of these are needed for the unification of man. The self of matter is really an illusion because matter is only temporary. The personal seems real and the permanent, but it is not. And seems real and permanent, but it is not. So when we look at the personality, we're looking at the lower self, which is only temporary. We get a new one with each life. And the individuality, which is the higher self, which is that Atma Buddhi principle. Atma is always present, but it needs that contact with Buddhi and then with the higher mind in order to be able to function on this plane. The voice says, the voice of the silence talks about the self of matter with basically that lower self, and the higher self of spirit. Basically, they really cannot meet. And this is when we talk about raising the self by the self, this is what is happening. The attempt is made to bring up the lower self, to bring up lower manas to the higher aspect of divinity. And it goes on to say, one of the twain must disappear. There is no room for both. So this is the fight that goes on every day within us between the higher nature and the lower nature. They truly both can't coexist peacefully. So the whole idea is to raise up that lower nature. We think it, what is it, subsumed? Is that the right word? To bring them all to bring it up. And it will disappear, but the lower mind is always there and it will always be a threat. It's just a matter of how strong our higher nature is in order to prevent the lower nature from raising its ugly head again. In this stage of evolution, the predominance of the lower is occurring, a dominance of the personal I. So when people say myself, this is what they're basically talking about, is the dominance of the personal I. And we're looking for the triumphing of the lower over the higher. So just to kind of go over again the difference between the two selves. Atma is the universal all, a ray of the divine. It becomes the higher self in conjunction with buddhi, but Atma is always a ray of the divine. The lower self is lower mind in conjunction with the passions and desires, and this is the personality, with the higher self being the individuality. And we want to just say that the spiritual ego, which is buddhi manas, is not the higher self. It is the individuality, it is the reincarnating ego. So we will go on with our second part of this.
As was mentioned, our umbrella theme for the month of February is facets of self-discipline. And in thinking of that phrase, it should come to our minds that self-discipline isn't just one thing. It's not just being good. It's not just studying. It's not being just being of service, but like a diamond with many facets which give it its brilliance and its value, self-discipline is like that. There are many different aspects, and we may be particularly good, but then we have to polish up one of the other facets. So we're going to look through this month at the various facets or aspects of self-discipline. And our first one is raising the self by the self, because it's really the one discipline, the one method, the one theme that underlies all the others that we will be talking about this month. And in this presentation this morning, we will touch on some of those, but not too much. So the Bhagavad Gita, it is said, is a book that can be read at several levels, several different keys to its understanding. And in reading the portion from the Bhagavad Gita, we had a commentary presented on, we might say, the metaphysical and the philosophical keys or facets of the Bhagavad Gita, if you will. So we're going to read that same portion again, but in this presentation, we're going to look at its practical and devotional key, which depend on the situation, the characters, and the conflict already laid out for us. So as it goes in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, page 45, Krishna instructs Arjuna, he should raise the self by the self. Let him not suffer the self to be lowered, for self is the friend of self, and in a like manner, self is its own enemy. Self is the friend of the man who is self-conquered, so self, like a foe, hath enmity to him who is not self-conquered. And in the footnote on that page, Mr. Judge writes that this whole paragraph is a play on the word self. And if you actually read the text, you see there's self that's spelled in the lowercase, and there's self that begins with the uppercase S, to indicate, to symbolize the lower and the higher selves we've had presented. Now, the lower self is said to be the enemy of the higher because it, by its nature, sets up a resistance to true development. It's like trying to drag an anchor with the boat. It's just the weight and the resistance just keeps you from moving forward. And yeah, so that anchor, in a sense, is the enemy to progress. But in the other sense, an enemy, the anchor is also a friend in a bad storm or in certain uncharted waters where you need stability. You need that anchor. You need that resistance. And so it's the same way with the lower self. It can be its own enemy, and it can be its friend, because its best interests really are to overcome that resistance and live in harmony with its higher nature. So Mr. Judge further explains in the notes on the Bhagavad Gita on this chapter, and it is very worthwhile if you don't have a copy of the notes of the Bhagavad Gita to pick that up, because for the Western student coming to these ancient philosophical and metaphysical ideas, it's a tremendous aid to our practical application. So he points out that in a way that the lower self is our enemy because it seems to be very weak. And it, on its own, as much as we personally desire, it's very difficult for us to overcome by the efforts of our personal desires the downward tendency of the lower self. That lower self will continually drag us down unless somehow we learn to master it. And that's the rub. That's the difficulty. How do we master it? How do we discipline this thing that Arjuna describes is as difficult to master and to control as the wind? You just can't seem to manage it. However, it can be conquered or it can be mastered, and once it does, it becomes a true friend and co-worker with the higher self. So what makes the lower self an enemy? What makes it weak? And it becomes weak because by its nature, the lower self, as we said, is manas, or the mind, the thinking principle blended with the principle of passions and desires. So we have these two representing the personality, the lower mind, the thinking principle blended with our passions and desires. Now, desire is a universal principle. It's not bad. It's just a principle. It's a basis. It's a power. It's a force. It can be expressed as will, and it can be seen in all the kingdoms. But in the human kingdom, the passions and desires in this period of time are predominant, and they have rule over our senses and organs. We cannot move our bodies without some kind of desire to move. And we know how our senses are influenced by the passions and desires, so much so that we are pretty much attracted and go after things that appear and taste and smell pleasurable to us, and we enjoy and we avoid others. So this desire principle works over our senses, and in another way it does too, because we see what we expect or want to hear. See, we hear, we listen to what we want to listen to, and maybe screen out what we don't. So even there, desire rules over the senses. But it also rules over our reasoning mind, and how often do we see that even as brilliant as we might be, we can be foolish in our actions. We can be irrational in our thinking, and we certainly can justify our most selfish desires, quite apparent to others with very good convoluted reasoning and thinking, and use what we want, what we really desire, to influence our thinking. And of course, the psychologists of the 20th century have made a school out of this principle and its application. But the desire principle also interferes with our intuition and our spiritual discernment. There are so many times when we have that voice of intuition, and we know what we should do, and we know what we should not do, and we can see the difference, but we just don't do it. We know, but we don't follow our inclinations. We do the opposite thing we know we should do, and we may feel very guilty or even hate ourselves for it afterwards. What is it? And Krishna explains, well, it's this principle of passion and desires that even has rule and can cloud over our discernment and our intuition. And sometimes it's so cloudy because of our desires, we cannot even see what we should do. And even though we're taught in school and by our parents and by our educators and priests and rabbis and religious leaders to do the right thing, what the right thing is, we very often don't. And it's this principle of passion and desire. So it's because of that that the lower self is really its own enemy and is weak and cannot raise because of this dragging weight of desire. It needs the help of the higher self, that universal spirit, the one self in each and all. And that's why one of the principal purposes of our gathering as United Lodge of Theosophists is to gain a truer realization of the self, because it is through that we have a key to understanding how to make ourselves better able to help and teach others to be a better human being. So how is it? What is the method? How do we raise the self by the self, by the higher self? So the mind and heart, or another way of saying it, our thoughts and our attention of the lower self must be made to stay at rest in the Supreme Spirit. Now, this is very difficult because the mind and heart are restless by nature. We only have to know our own minds and see how it wanders around to this thing and that thing, and our hearts can be very fickle and want one thing one day and another thing the next day, and one day we're in the mood for something and we're not. It's very restless. And it's also restless and unreliable because it's inclined to be concerned with pleasurable and painful experiences of the senses. It's preoccupied with that. Personal feelings, how many days, how many hours do we spend brooding on what somebody said or some problem? They just preoccupy our likes and dislikes, what we like and dislike about other people or the conditions we're in, as well as painful and pleasant memories. And we relive uselessly over and over again things in the past we cannot change, we cannot control, but the mind's restless. So the lower self, by its own nature, is not equal-minded. It's not free of that. So effort is required. Self-induced and self-devised effort is required of the lower nature to begin to attend to the higher self. So we speak very generally of raising the self by the self, but we need to understand that it begins where we are, as personalities, as beings fully aware of our limitations and our faults, but determined to make a change and to work with it. And so the Bhagavad Gita is really a book for that individual who cannot run away from the fight and has to take the fight on. And he says, even a little of this practice delivers a man from great evil. And it does require practice. It's not something you can do once in a while. It has to become a daily discipline. It's a facet of self-discipline. It has to become as important to you as eating the right food or wearing the right clothes or saying the right things at work or doing your job. It has to become a conscious practice. And so we need practice and we need patience. We did not get our high school diplomas in 6 months. And we're not going to get our diploma in self-mastery in a few months. It's going to take patience. We're going to have to give time to this process. And it's going to require effort. And by degrees, bit by bit, it's not a sudden change overnight. By degrees, as we go through these grades, we gradually find more and more bliss, rest, and equal-mindedness. Now, it may not be perfect, but it's better than it was. That's why Krishna says, even a little of this practice delivereth a man from great risk. So every desire we have, every impulse to action, every thought that does not serve the higher self must be abandoned and attention placed back on the Supreme Spirit. It's almost like a game. It's almost like a game that children might play with the boards that slide back and forth and the balls rolling around, and they're trying to feel the balance, and the ball goes this way and they try to straighten. Remember those old games. So it's like that, because as we watch ourselves, our thoughts, our behaviors, we see they get a little off balance. We've got to abandon them and bring ourselves at rest in the Supreme Spirit, meaning become aware of who we are as observing spiritual thinking beings. So when we see ourselves too passionate in the wrong way, liking and disliking, we need to replace that passion with compassion, because compassion is not an attribute. It's the law of laws. It is the self. It is the fact of the unity and the fitness of all things. It's our awareness of that wells up as that sense of compassion. So we need to replace our passion with compassion. That's raising the self by the self. When we see selfish action or the tendency to be selfish in our action. We need to replace it with devotion. That brings it back the balance. That brings back the rest. So we may have a tendency or a desire to want to do something selfishly. We have to recognize it for what it is and make the effort to be devoted to the interests of another and being altruistic. Now that can be hard. You know, it seems to fly right in the face of all our instincts and our desires, but that's what it means to bring the lower self in line with the higher, because devotion to the interests of others, devotion to the benefit of others, altruism is in harmony with the self of all. You treat yourself, others like you would treat yourselves. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It's the recognition of there is only one self. The self in me is the self in thee. Separate of ideas we have. How could that person do that to me? Or I can do better than that. Or I don't deserve that. Why are separate of ideas that separate us from other human beings, from other conditions, must be replaced with thoughts of the unity of all things, that there is one spirit, one source of all things, and all things exist in space. So it's like thinking of the universe as this little room. This is all there is. This is all I am. This is all just here. Everything else is separate. But space is much larger than that. There's space that goes out outside of this room. There's space that goes within the furniture. There's infinite directions of space. So there's a larger dimension to life. And all this exists in space, and that space exists in everything. The same way with all human beings. We are not separate. We all are united in this one universal wholeness, space, deity, if you will. And the more we place our thought on that, the more we do not attend to the idea of separateness. So having attended to the higher self in this way, having made the effort, the lower self begins to feel the influence of the higher power and wisdom that's resident in that higher nature. You take a step towards the higher, and the higher, we say, takes a step towards you. There's a mutual attraction. So it's not an all, it's all not, it's all not. It's not a one-way thing. You're not making all the effort. You're being helped by your own nature in return. And with that help, with that power of will, with that insight of spiritual knowledge, the lower self becomes strong. It's able to burst the bonds of matter, the illusions of the senses, and free itself from the chains of desire. And then that personality, that lower self, is no longer the enemy. It is a true servant of the inner divine ruler, the higher self. It's no longer weak. It is consciously united with its the true self of nature, and it becomes a god on earth, the reflection of the Father within. And all the great personages we think about in history, Buddha, Jesus, Krishna, they all represent that great human struggle. At some point in some life, that individual had to make a vow, an intention to follow a certain path of self-discipline until finally, after long effort, we see the blooming forth of the perfect vehicle for the expression of that divine within. But that same path, that same potential lies within every human being. And that's what they taught. So we open this now to your questions and comments.
Yes, in the front.
It seems that every time one tries, we fail. Why is it so often we hear in these teachings that failure is success? It doesn't feel that way.
Well, for one thing, we learn from our failures, and we know, we've heard, we think it was it Ford or Edison made hundreds of failures before he, you know, came upon the correct idea, the correct invention. So if we learn from those failures, we can actually say that they're not failures. But our minds, our lower mind, is connected to that idea that if we're not successful, then we're failures. But if we look at the positive side of it and think, okay, I didn't do it right, not use the word failure, but I didn't do it right, let me try again. Let me learn from whatever it is that I haven't been able to succeed.
You know, this is the key to the Bhagavad Gita. We judge our success and failure by measuring it according to the outcome of our effort. If I try something and it doesn't turn out the way I expected, it's a failure. Where Krishna turns it around, he says, regardless of the outcome, the real action is in the motive. The real success and failure is why you did what you did. What was the motive? What was the devotion? If you act that way, the results will naturally come under law. Now, it may not come out the way you intended because of the actions or others or the interference of other lines of law, but it's not a failure. It will bring out its effect in the course of time. There can be a delayed reaction. And the other aspect to that question is there's no failure in that if we learn from the failure said, but also try again, keep trying. The only failure is the decision to stop trying, to give up, to succumb to the weakness and the downward drag of the personality and just let it carry you away. To fail as a spiritual being in your duty to raise that lower self by the self.
Yes.
Well, so therefore these voices that I hear in my head, probably everyone hears them in some way, shape, or form. And you know, there seems to be a constant battle going on in our life. And we've always wondered if I'm struggling so badly and I'm looking within, what happens to those that are looking without and they have this battle going on within? What manifests in their life? Certainly not peace and harmony, I would think.
We feel as though having these ideas, knowing a portion of this philosophy, is a gift because we have additional tools at hand to look at any situation in our lives and know that they are of our making, that that it is our responsibility, that we can't be looking to an outside God, blaming him for everything that has happened to us. And we can't put it out to an outside God and thanking him for all the good things that have come to us at the same time. But we take responsibility. We know about karma, that whatever it is that comes to us is ours of the making. So that if there is this conversation going on in our head about should or shouldn't we do something, why did this happen and why didn't that happen, we know that it is our responsibility to take what comes to us and to deal with it and not blame it on any other person, not to blame it on the universe, not to blame it on God, but to either thank or blame ourselves for what we have done in the past that we've brought forward in this life.
Well, the second part of that question was, well, what happens to the person who isn't introspective and looking within and recognizing the conflicting voices of reason and conscience and intuition, the voice of the silence versus the voice of our passions and senses that pull us in another way. What about the person who isn't that way because they're living in the outer world? They're living only concerned with the experiences of the senses, what they can see, what they can taste, the acquiring things on the physical plane. Well, we need to understand this principle taught in the Bhagavad Gita as well as in Theosophy, that the outer world is but the effect, the expression of the inner reality. So all our outer battles are really reflections or manifestations of the inner battle condition going on with the human heart and mind in general. So the one who is not looking within to face the battles in their own nature, but is only looking out and fighting and living in the world, will still be fighting, but their battles will be with other human beings. Their battles will be with their family, with their peers, with their employers, with their political and religious and civil opponents, with other countries, with other... Their battles will all be on the plane of the physical life, but the issues involved will still be the same. The psychological, the moral issues will still be the same, except the playing out, the trying to resolve them will be on the field of the physical. And no lasting peace, no lasting resolution has ever come from winning a battle on the physical plane. As even our politicians and leaders know, you have to win the hearts and minds of the people. You can't just win them in a physical victory. So like ourselves, we have to conquer our hearts and minds if we really want peace and bliss and understanding.
What is the role of pain in raising the self by the self? Where does physical, emotional pain, is that a help or a hindrance?
I have a reading here, just so happens. This is a very interesting article. It's from Magazine Theosophy, Volume 6, page 460. It's entitled The Awakening to the Self, and it's a compilation of statements by Sankaracharya. And he says here, passion, desire, pleasure, pain move the mind, but when the mind rests in deep sleep, they cease. They belong to the mind, not to the self. And there was another one here. Sorry. And he says, at first wrapped in unwisdom, when unwisdom is destroyed, the pure self shines forth of itself like the radiant sun when the clouds have passed. So we can, in regards to pain, whether it's physical or emotional pain, again, this is something that we've brought onto ourselves by karmic issues that we have performed or not performed in the past. So it's something that we have to learn from. And we know in regards to physical pain, two examples we know are HPB and Mr. Judge dealt with just huge amounts of physical pain. And we also know that emotional pain they dealt with as well when, you know, people were speaking ill of them. So these are two examples, and we know that there are a lot more in history and currently that we need to look at this pain and realize that this is something that we have brought on ourselves. I mean, it could be, you know, physically not taking care of ourselves, emotional pain from whatever has happened in past lives that we've brought forward. So they're lessons. Mr. Judge calls them opportunities.
So pain, like the lower self, is our best friend and it's our worst enemy. How often has emotional pain or physical pain brought somebody to despair? To reckless abandonment of life and responsibilities, of completely falling away from their duties and responsibilities. Why is it that we cannot help but see images of people suffering and pain and recognizing that this is something we need to alleviate? This is not right. This is so pain is our enemy. But pain is a friend, because pain wakes us up to the suffering of others. It inspires compassion, it inspires care, sympathy, empathy. Pain wakes us up that maybe we're doing something wrong and should be trying something different. Instead of butting our head against the wall and keep getting a headache, maybe we'll start looking for a hole in the wall. So it forces us to look a different way, to maybe try something new and different. So those who are wise and powerful say that all their knowledge, all their gifts, all their powers have been achieved through struggle and overcoming pain in one degree or another. So without pain, there is no gain in that sense, even on the spiritual, mental, and moral planes.
Yeah, we found the quote from Sankaracharya, another one. As I am other than mind, not mine are pain, rage, hate, and fear. The self, the higher self he's meaning, is above the outward life, and the mind according to the words of wisdom. So if we are focusing on the higher mind, then we can be above those emotions.
But in seeing this conflict, there's something that's observing it. Now, what is it that's observing? The higher mind, lower mind?
What's observing? Oh, observing.
These two aspects of ourselves.
Well, it is the higher self. The higher self is the power to perceive, to know. And then we, of course, have, as was said, that trinity of Atmabuddhi Manas, higher self working through its vehicle, individualized in a thinking principle. So we not only have the power to know, we are knowers. We not only have the power to perceive, we are individual perceivers. So that is our individuality in one sense, or we might say it's the higher self that is the seer, the witness of all the changing experiences. And so whether we're dealing with the lower self or the mind or pain or pleasure, all those changing aspects of life, the constant reality is that we are the perceivers of them in our own nature. We can learn from them, we can be distracted by them, but in our higher nature, we are not affected by them. We are eternal, we are changeless, we are constant. We go through them. They come and go, we persist. We are eternal beings. So it's that realization that allows us to detach from the limitations, the difficulties of life, and raise ourselves as well as help others.
Yes.
Could we have another repetition of the aim and purpose of all of this?
The aim and purpose of just this particular topic? Of anything?
This topic can be spread out. This particular today's topic, what is the aim and purpose?
Well, we need, as one of the questions asked was, what if we're just focusing on our outer life? What if we are just looking at God? What if we are thinking more of ourselves rather than others? The whole idea of learning to raise the self by the self is to focus on, as was stated in the other talk, about compassion, about universal brotherhood. And this is actually the way that we can experience a higher nature, is by helping others, by focusing on universal brotherhood. Because if we can raise that higher self and bring along the lower self with it, then we will be more of a spiritual being, which is the ultimate goal, is perfection. But as long as we are looking at universal brotherhood as the vehicle to accomplish that. So the whole idea of raising the self by the self is our journey to spiritual life.
So to state that simply, in another way, the aim and purpose. The aim is self-discipline. That's what we're shooting at. That's the center of the target. We want to discipline the selves. That's the overall theme of our month. The purpose is why we're shooting at the target to begin with, why we're aiming there to begin with. So we want to discipline ourselves. That's our aim, for the purpose of making ourselves better able to help and teach others. In doing that, we become a better servant of humanity, whatever walk of life we are. So that's what we say, that the theosophists, regard as theosophists, all those who are engaged in the true service of humanity, because they're engaged in some kind of self-discipline to make themselves a better human being. And understanding the nature of the personality, whether they call themselves Christians or Jews or Muslims or whatever, they have to be relying on something higher than their personalities. They may call it by a different name, they may think of it differently, but they have to be relying on something higher than their own nature to lift it up. As Krishna says, in whatever way men approach me, in that way do I assist them. So that is our one aim and purpose.
Actually, our question was going to be, is there anything in Judaism, Christianity, or Islam that corresponds to raising the self by the self, but it just came out in the last sentence?
Yeah.
So we would like to follow that up with, if you talk to a lot of folks of those religions, they're just really not, this is not going to come out. So often it's going to be, well, God does it for me. You know, even though it's available, if depending on how they interpret their own scriptures. But nevertheless, all that's really saying is raising the self by the self in those religions is there nevertheless for those who are at a place where just live an ethical life, live a pious life. And until one, we think, probably has demonstrated to himself and the rest of the universe that he is willing to live that ethical life, you know, these ideas may not be obviously available to him. Almost like this idea, I mean, it's not an esoteric secret because it's published in print, but it's certainly not something that, you know, all the folks know about and try to do, yet would they benefit from it? And I guess our point is, step one is live your ethical life, and then things will open up in different ways.
Well, we know, we're sure that everyone knows a lot of people from different religions who are just kind and generous, compassion. They go out of their way to help others. There's so many small agencies in the poor sections of the city that help with food and clothing, school supplies. And these are unsung heroes. These people are helping others, putting out their own money, their own time, volunteering. Yet we think that if one would ask them why they do it, we know that they would bring in the whole idea about their religion would be involved with it. But then we don't know what their motives are. And the whole idea with helping of others, you know, and it goes into great detail in the Bhagavad Gita about we just lost our train of thought, about motive, about why we do something, that we shouldn't be looking for the end point. We shouldn't be looking for what's going to come back to me about it. But, I mean, there are a lot of very good people that are doing things because it has to be done. And that's the whole theosophical idea regarding duty, is that we are doing it because it has come to us and because we have seen it and because it needs to be done.
So the word theosophy means divine wisdom. And there's divine wisdom at the heart of all the great world religions worthy of the name. The so-called founders of those religions who gave it its initial impetus were wise human beings who were incarnate divine wisdom. And their ethical, philosophical, mystical teachings could not help but be echoes, reflections, portions of the ancient wisdom, the accumulated wisdom of the ages. But like anything, over time, with the disciples taking it on, to trying to promulgate it, to try to make it more appealing to those, and more understandable to those that may have less understanding, it assumes certain symbols and trappings. And so we have religions beginning to differentiate, express different ways in different parts of the world to different people. And people begin to identify with those outer divergencies rather than the fundamental roots and truths from which they all come. So it's my religion or your religion or this religion. So religion, in our sense, is our best friend and it's our worst enemy. So because it's very often made to appeal just to the lower self. What theosophy tries to do is take the lessons, but expand our understanding to this. Really just doesn't have to do with our personal lives, but religion unlocks keys and mysteries to understanding our whole nature, our higher self, as well as our personality, where we fit in the whole scheme of things, why we're here, all those unanswered mysteries that we very often find in religion as it's expressed.
So yes.
And back. Okay.
There's a the lower self with all small letters, the higher self with the capital S, but there's a third self with all capitals. How does that self, what is that self and how does it work with the other two? Mm-hmm.
It's just a different way of emphasizing the same principle. We've seen the same writers use those same expressions in this, in different ways. So at some point, the writer, when referring to the higher self, will use the self in all capital letters, and in another case, will use the self with just the one S, being the initial S being capitalized. And as Mr. Judge says, the point there is to discriminate, to differentiate between the higher self, which is universal spirit, the self of all, and the personal self, which feels itself to be separate from all of life. So we'll stop here. Next week, we're continuing in our discussions on the facets of self-discipline with a renunciation of self-interest. So obviously, the self-interest is the interest of the personality that we need to renounce, not the higher self. So, and then on Wednesday, we're going to be talking about reincarnation, the whole idea that character accounts for our various differences that we have, and where does that character ultimately originate, how reincarnation explains that. So we invite you to come again to help and participate. Our meeting's adjourned. Okay.